through violent means including trained and organized armed groups. Russia also slammed U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken as boorish for saying Kazakhstan would be settled with Russian presence after asking Moscow to send in troops. This came after Blinken told reporters on Friday
that I think one lesson of recent history is that once Russians are in your house, it's sometimes very difficult to get them to leave.
Moscow ramped up the criticism further, also going on to sign a number of Washington's invasions, interventions, and military occupations over the decades, suggesting Blinken might learn a history lesson of his own. It mentioned unfortunate people who had the bad luck to see these uninvited guests at their doorstep, naming Native Americans, Koreans, Vietnamese, and Syrians, among others.
But Russia has much better track record than the United States, because the United States has about 800 military objects and bases around the globe, and staying unwelcome in a lot of countries.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Kazakh counterpart, Kasym-Jomart Tokayev, held a phone conversation to discuss the ongoing unrest in Kazakhstan on Saturday. The two discussed steps to restore order in the country. Tokayev also informed Putin in detail about the situation in the country, noting that it is developing towards a stabilization.
On January 3, 2020, the United States assassinated Iran's Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani alongside the deputy commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in a drone strike at the Baghdad airport.
When American democracy is a complete sham, as it was under Trump, and it reached its apotheosis, you could say, with the assassination of a great anti-ISIS fighter, really the main force that was fighting ISIS.
5 days later, Iran launched a barrage of ballistic missiles at Iraq's Ain al-Assad airbase housing U.S. troops in retaliation for the assassination, leaving scores of casualties. The Pentagon downplayed the number of troops injured in the strike, but later admitted that over 100 of its personnel suffered traumatic brain injuries. One died by suicide in October.
See, this, I think this is probably what Pompeo and Trump were counting on. They thought, we'll kill the Soleimani, and then maybe Iran will attack us, and that will give us an excuse to go to war against Iran. I'm sure that was their plan. You didn't do that. It's very wise. When you're dealing with an enraged bull, you don't poke it. You go around it, you figure out where its weak spots are, you do that kind of strategizing.
This is what the head of the United States Central Command has told a New Yorker journalist about the airstrike on Ain al-Assad airbase.
They hit pretty much where they wanted to hit. They can strike effectively across the breadth and the depth of the Middle East. They could strike with accuracy and they could strike with volume.
The American general has admitted that Iran's missile capabilities have given the Islamic Republic overmatch, a military term meaning a level of military prowess where the country can overwhelm the enemy by a significant margin. Last August, the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan in a matter of weeks and seized control of the capital Kabul while the US troops were still present in the country. Observers believe the United States' withdrawal from the Central Asian country will go down in history as one of the most chaotic moves Washington has ever made. But a senior commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says Americans will have to leave Iraq in a more humiliating manner than the way they left Afghanistan. The commander of the IRGC's Quds Force said the Americans are facing various problems in the region while a resistance front is advancing on a daily basis. Brigadier General Ismail Ghani noted that the resistance fighters are now equipped with missiles and weapons that can target U.S. warships anywhere in the region. The senior commander said Americans will be finally uprooted from the region. He made the remarks at a ceremony in the Iranian city of Mashhad on the second anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis.
I don't know. You ask if the U.S. has got the message. Well, sometimes people or nations are so foolish that they go to such a point with their mistaken agenda that it just collapses completely. So that seems to be what's going to happen. I don't know when it will happen, but there seems to be very little possibility of a rational U.S. government.
Despite the United States and its allies' repeated threats, Iran has proven its ability to make good on its promise to mete out a crushing response to any possible aggressor.
Just days into 2022, North Korea carried out a major weapons test. It launched a hypersonic missile this week, with North Korean media saying the projectile precisely hit its target at a distance of 700 kilometers. This was North Korea's second test of a hypersonic missile. Unlike ballistic missiles that fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory, hypersonic weapons fly at lower altitudes and can achieve more than five times the speed of sound. Analysts say, however, the main feature of hypersonic weapons is not their speed, but their maneuverability makes them much harder to detect by radar. The North is currently part of a small group of countries, including the United States and China, in trying to develop hypersonic military technologies.
They have a plan. They have a plan that is public, there is no secret, is available. So they have several devices, several weapon range that they want to develop. And one category is the hypersonic one.
The latest test firing came days after North's leader Kim Jong-un pledged once again to boost Pyongyang's defenses. He said in a New Year's speech that Pyongyang would continue to strengthen its capabilities because the Korean Peninsula still faces an increasingly unstable military environment. North Korea tested different projectiles last year amid stalled talks with the United States and its southern neighbor. Under former U.S. President Donald Trump, America and North Korea came close to a conflict before a series of meetings between the two adversaries' presidents. The high-profile summits broke down with no agreement, making Trump's approach towards North Korea another one of his major failures. North Korea has been subjected to Western sanctions for decades. Its relationship with the U.S. and its southern neighbors, South Korea and Japan, both staunch American allies, has been fraught with tensions for a very long time. North Korea is grappling with economic sanctions and chronic food shortages. Pyongyang has suffered under sanctions, but it has somehow managed to withstand the American pressure campaign.
They managed to avoid any trouble to their economy in the same way that many other countries that are under sanctions are doing. So basically they readjust their economy in a way that they can survive.
Despite its long list of economic problems, the North has managed to produce several nuclear warheads, describing them as a necessary insurance against an attack by the U.S. The U.S., which has been calling on North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons, has left no stone unturned to isolate the communist state. But successive U.S. administrations have failed to force North Korea into submission. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration now says it is open to talks, but the North says that's implausible given the record of American hostile policies. The North seems too weary of American ulterior motives. What if it abandons its atomic arms and the U.S. does not drop its hostile policies and keeps up the pressure? This must be one of the key questions that comes to the North Korean leader's mind when he focuses on his country's relationship with America. The North insists that the White House has been determined to take and reluctant to give during past talks. It remains to be seen how Biden will act now to try to ease tensions on the Korean Peninsula.
in the limelight.
By no means has voting blue meant a change for the better. In fact, the only real difference between Biden and Trump in terms of foreign policy is that, instead of mean tweets, more respectful language is used to give the new president the veneer of respectability, says Robert in Lakesh Journalist in an article titled, Biden's Diplomacy is Back, Falls Flat as 2021 West Asia Policy, a Miserable Flop. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. Throughout his political career, Biden, whatever may have been his personal misgivings, supported the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, voting to launch the invasions and working under the Obama administration on a policy to continue what he now calls the forever wars. In Iraq, unlike Afghanistan, 2021 did not see the U.S. withdrawal. Instead, it has pursued a policy of aggression and lawlessness, followed by an agreement with some people that will guarantee a U.S. presence in the country for the foreseeable future, a move celebrated by many of Biden's supporters. The Biden administration did announce a supposed drawdown in Iraq, which was to be done under the guise of ending the U.S. combat mission inside the country. Despite claims that the combat mission has ended and that relevant troops were withdrawn, 2,500 U.S. troops are still in Iraq and are likely there to stay. The reality is that the U.S. has never stated it had ground troops in Iraq to begin with. It claimed to use only special forces units, describing other troops as trainers and advisors to Iraq's security forces. Therefore, the connotations ascribed to the phrase ending the U.S. combat mission are incorrect. For there hasn't been a combat mission in the country for years. But what of the deadly Predator drone program, which became infamous under former President Barack Obama? Biden has, since taking office, refused to comment on the practice of so-called targeted killings and assassinations, which overwhelmingly kill civilians and not combatants. It is also difficult to tell exactly how many were killed in drone strikes this year, owing to a Trump-era ruling that scrapped the need to report drone strike deaths. Despite this, we do not know that the Biden administration has used the targeted killing program in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia. In Syria and Iraq, at least two separate airstrike campaigns were undertaken by the U.S. president without congressional approval. The U.S. is still also illegally occupying a third of Syria's territory, sitting on over 90% of the country's oil resources, as well as its most fertile agricultural lands, going so far as to send poisoned seeds for Syrians to cultivate. When the Syrian government announced that it could not use the seeds because they would potentially destroy fertile soil, the U.S. regime insisted the seeds were good and refused to apologize. In the case of airstrikes in Somalia, a dangerous escalation occurred when the U.S. terrorist military forces ordered strikes against militants without even notifying the U.S. president, a move that Biden failed to condemn. On the issue of Palestine, Biden has acted as expected. After all, he openly describes himself as a Zionist. When Palestinians were being ethnically cleansed from their homes in East Al-Quds so that illegal settlers could steal their properties and racist lynch mobs attacked Palestinians around Al-Quds Old City, Biden remained completely uncritical of the Zionist regime's policy of protecting the settlers and attacking Palestinian protesters. In May, when the violence escalated into a war between Gaza and the Zionist regime's military, during which the fake regime of Israel killed 270 Palestinians, the president repeated the age-old "Israel has the right to defend itself" line, a trope repeatedly used by Washington when Tel Aviv carries out what have become routine civilian killing sprees. The Zionist regime's current Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, is openly opposed to a two-state solution and has rebuffed American demands to hold settlement expansion. Yet Biden has yet to muster a word of criticism of his Israeli counterpart. Instead of reining in its ally, the U.S. approved $1 billion of additional funding for the Zionist regime's Iron Dome air defense system to pay for what amounts to the inconvenience caused when killing Palestinians with U.S. taxpayer-funded bombs causes a reaction from the besieged Gaza Strip's armed groups. On Iran, Biden claimed he was going to differ from his predecessor Donald Trump, stating during his 2020 campaign that we've lost our standing in the region and vowing a change of tone and policy from Trump's openly hostile stance. Since he took office, though, Biden's promises to force his way back into the Obama-era Iran nuclear deal were soon forgotten. And instead, he has charged forward with Trump's maximum pressure campaign. Instead of attempting to make peace, Biden has added even more sanctions to those levied by Trump, which were previously criticized and condemned by the International Court of Justice as a violation of international law. The Biden administration's first year of diplomacy first policy in the West Asia region has closed as many veterans of U.S. elections predicted. By no means has voting blue meant a change for the better. In fact, the only real difference between Biden and Trump in terms of foreign policy is that instead of mean tweets, more respectful language is used to give the new president the veneer of respectability, while carrying on an all-too-familiar violent and imperialistic West Asia region foreign policy.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
the U.S. military and allied air forces have dropped over 337,000 bombs and missiles on other countries over the last 20 years. That is an average of 46 strikes per day for two decades. Enough. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Media Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davis, anti-war activists. This article is published under the heading, "Hey, Hey, USA, how many bombs did you drop today?" Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Pentagon has finally published its first air power summary since President Biden took office nearly a year ago. These monthly reports have been published since 2007 to document the number of bombs and missiles dropped by U.S.-led air forces in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria since 2004. But President Trump stopped publishing them after February 2020, shrouding continued U.S. bombing in secrecy. Over the past 20 years, as documented, U.S. and allied air forces have dropped over 337,000 bombs and missiles on other countries. That is an average of 46 strikes per day for 20 years. This endless bombardment has not only been deadly and devastating for its victims, but is broadly recognized as seriously undermining international peace and security and diminishing America's standing in the world. The U.S. government and political establishment have been remarkably successful at keeping the American public in the dark about the horrific consequences of these long-term campaigns of mass destruction, allowing them to maintain the illusion of U.S. militarism as a force for good in the world in their domestic political rhetoric. Now, even in the face of the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan, they are doubling down on their success at selling this counterfactual narrative to the American public to reignite their old Cold War with Russia and China, dramatically and predictably increasing the risk of nuclear war. The new air power summary data revealed that the United States has dropped another 3,246 bombs and missiles on Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. 2,068 under Trump and 1,178 under Biden since February 2020. The good news is that the U.S. bombing of those three countries has significantly decreased from the over 12,000 bombs and missiles it dropped on them in 2019. In fact, since the withdrawal of U.S. occupation forces from Afghanistan in August, the U.S. military has officially conducted no air strikes there and only dropped 13 bombs and missiles on Iraq and Syria, although this does not preclude additional unreported strikes by forces under CIA command or control. The speed with which the U.S. installed government fell to the Taliban once the U.S. withdrawal was underway confirmed how 20 years of hostile military occupation, aerial bombardment, and support for corrupt governments ultimately served only to drive the war-weary people of Afghanistan back to Taliban rule. Biden's decision to follow 20 years of colonial occupation and aerial bombardment in Afghanistan with the same kind of brutal economic siege warfare the United States has inflicted on Cuba, Iran, North Korea, and Venezuela can only further discredit America in the eyes of the world. There has been no accountability for these 20 years of senseless destruction. Even with the publication of air power summaries, the ugly reality of U.S. bombing wars and the mass casualties they inflict remain largely hidden from the American people. How many of the 3,246 attacks documented in the air power summary since February 2020 were you aware of before reading this article? You probably heard about the drone strike that killed 10 Afghan civilians in Kabul in August 2020. But what about the other 3,245 bombs and missiles? Whom did they kill or maim? And whose homes did they destroy? The December 2021 New York Times expose of the consequences of U.S. airstrikes, the result of a five-year investigation, was stunning, not only for the high civilian casualties and military lies it exposed, but also because it revealed just how little investigative reporting the U.S. media have done on these two decades of war. In America's industrialized, remote-controlled air wars, even the U.S. military personnel most directly and intimately involved are shielded from human contact with the people whose lives they are destroying, while for most of the American public, it is as if these hundreds of thousands of deadly explosions never even happened. The lack of public awareness of U.S. airstrikes is not the result of a lack of concern for the mass destruction the U.S. government commits in their names. In rare cases, we find out about, like the murderous drone strike in Kabul in August, the public wants to know what happened and strongly supports U.S. accountability for civilian death. So public ignorance of 99% of U.S. airstrikes and their consequences is not the result of public apathy, but of deliberate decisions by the U.S. military, politicians of both parties and corporate media to keep the public in dark. The largely unremarked 21-month-long suppression of monthly air power summaries is only the latest example of this. Now that the new air power summary has filled in the previously hidden figures for 2020 to 2021. Here is the most complete data available on 20 years of deadly and destructive U.S. and Allied airstrikes. The failure of the U.S. government, politicians, and corporate media to honestly inform and educate the American public about the systematic mass destruction wreaked by their country's armed forces has allowed this carnage to continue largely unremarked and unchecked for 20 years. It has also left Americans precariously vulnerable to the revival of an anachronistic Manichaean Cold War narrative that risks even greater catastrophe. In this topsy-turvy, through-the-looking-glass narrative, the country actually bombing cities to rubble and waging wars that kill millions of people presents itself as a well-intentioned force for good in the world. Then it paints countries like China, Russia, and Iran, which have understandably strengthened their defenses to deter the United States from attacking them as threats to the American people and to the world peace.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us. The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami.
A few years ago I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Similar to the other topics where we have spoken about social justice, social awareness, if we don't have this element of practice in our lives, then there is no such thing as social justice or social awareness. And that is to be individually and collectively responsible for the betterment of our society. And that can only be done by us encouraging good to be performed, and by blocking and stopping and deterring bad to be practiced. And this is what we call in Islam, al-amr bil-ma'roof wal-nahi anil munkar. If someone has a wrong approach of forbidding you to do wrong, and you, I'm not talking about no random person here, I'm talking about you, the mu'min, the shi'i, if someone has a wrong approach of doing nahi anil munkar to you, and you know that it's munkar, they're wrong. Their approach is wrong. They will be held responsible and accountable for that. But if you know that it's something wrong, then do it. Do what it is that he is or she is telling you, and that is to forbid it. If their approach to do Amr bil Ma'ruf is also wrong, if you know that it is something that's Ma'ruf, then uphold it and observe it. And that's why there are different levels. When I know, even if I use the best of approaches, sometimes you could be the sweetest of talkers, you could be the nicest of people, you could say it in the most polite way, but it will still be taken by this person as something bad, and you judging them, and you wronging them, and you accusing them, and all these other words, unfortunately, that are frequently mentioned in today's world. And so, what do you do in this case? It's always been a problem and an issue, you know, not only now and today. Yes, the kind of scenarios are different, you know, before, when Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahi an Munkar were done, they were done, you know, maybe face to face, for example. But today, when someone does want to implement Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi an Munkar in the best form, they really feel that they themselves are being attacked, and they themselves become very, very lonely in their attempt to want to establish the good in society and to forbid the wrong in society. And that's why we always need to make sure that we, if I could say, choose our battles. And again, I'm not talking only in those kind of confrontational ways. I'm saying in general, you know, there are a lot of things that you would love people to do. There are a lot of things that you would love people to stop doing, but unfortunately, they don't have that capacity, and they might, in most cases, unfortunately, take it in the wrong way as well. And that's why Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, "Adna al-inkar," the lowest level, the least level of al-inkar, which means for you to detest and hate and want to forbid that wrong, is an tulqi ahl al-ma'asi, that when you meet sinful people, you meet them bi wujuhin mukfahiratin, mukfahira, which basically means that when you meet them, you don't meet them with a happy face, you meet them with a frowning face. That's the least kind of munkar that you do.
Oh.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
So you see people doing wrong. You know they are doing something haram. You don't act all hippy-dippy with them with a smile on your face. You know, you show them your discontent. You show them that you are not happy with what it is that they are doing. And that's the least level of munkar. If you can't say it verbally, as the hadith says, if you can't do it physically, then you do it verbally. If you can't do it verbally, then you do it with your heart. Your heart needs to be discontent. So let's say, for example, you have someone in today's social media who, you know, posts something, him being in an inappropriate place, for example. And you know that that's munkar. Or her dressed in a particular way. Or her conducting herself in a particular way. And you know that's munkar. You don't like the post. You don't comment in a positive way on the post. If you don't want to say something to discourage them from the haram that they're doing, at least don't like it. You might want to inbox them if you know that there's going to be an effect or an impact on that. But if you know that disliking their post or unfriending them or inboxing them or whatnot is going to be of no use, then at least don't become a part of the problem. Don't become, as we say, their partner in the haram, in the committing of the haram. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he says, and that's why I said, when it does come to this whole issue of Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi an Munkar, we need to look at it beyond just confronting someone and saying, do this or, not, or don't do that. No, there are many applications of Al Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi an Munkar. You starting up a gathering, you having a website, you distributing a book, you delivering a lecture, you visiting someone. All these kind of ways, you know, let's say you know that this particular person, he's not that religious. But if you visit them, and not talk about religion or anything, but just become their friend, just become someone that they, you know, can respect, that is a way of Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi an Munkar. You know, the verse says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Qu anfusakum wa ahlikum. One of the applications of wiqaya, of safeguarding, is al-amr bil-ma'ruf wa-nahi an al-munkar. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
in the limelight.
In Britain, Boris Johnson's former Brexit minister, who quit last month, has warned him to commit to low taxes and the free market, or risk losing the next election. As Prime Minister, Boris Johnson comes under continuing pressure from the Conservative right. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's deputy political editor, Rowena Mason. The piece is titled, PM Must Commit to Low Taxes or Risk Losing the Next Election, says David Frost. Boris Johnson's former Brexit minister, who quit last month, has warned him to commit to low taxes and the free market, or risk losing the next election, as the Prime Minister comes under continuing pressure from the Conservative right. David Frost, the former lobbyist whom Boris Johnson made his chief Brexit negotiator and later gave a peerage, said in his first major interview since quitting as a cabinet minister that the Tories needed to focus on rebuilding the nation and be proud of our history. Lord Frost resigned before Christmas, citing concerns about the direction of travel of the government, particularly over COVID rules. However, it also came at a difficult time for the UK's negotiations with the European Union, as it emerged that Britain was prepared to drop demands for EU judges to be stripped of their role in overseeing Northern Ireland. Since then, David Frost has signalled his intention to join with others on the right of the Tory party, becoming a member of the so-called COVID Recovery Group, which is sceptical of restrictions and focused on getting the economy moving. The Tory peer told the Mail on Sunday, he said, "We need to get the country going economically again, and that means free markets, free debate and low taxes. People need to look at this country and think, yes, something is changing here. You've got to set the direction of travel. If we're going to get out of this little trough and win the election in a couple of years' time, then we've got to develop that." His demand for tax cuts comes amid growing unease among Thatcherite Tories about the government's plans for a rise in national insurance contributions this April, with Jacob Rees-Mogg, the leader of the Commons, pressed Boris Johnson to scrap at Cabinet this week. David Frost also criticised the advisers around Boris Johnson and joined the many Tory backbenchers calling for a shake-up of the number 10 team, while insisting he's still the right leader. "I think he probably needs better support around him in the team to deliver on that. The Prime Minister has a right, when he wants something to happen, for the levers that he pulls to actually produce something," he said. David Frost added, "And he has the right to the best possible advice around him, so I think there needs to be machinery changes and there probably needs to be some different voices around him to make sure that he gets the best possible advice." David Frost's successor as the chief negotiator with the European Union is Liz Truss, the Foreign Secretary, who warned in an interview with the Sunday Telegraph that she was just as prepared as him to trigger Article 16 of the post-Brexit agreement on Northern Ireland if necessary. Liz Truss said she would suggest constructive proposals to her EU counterpart, Maroš Šefčovič, this week, during their first face-to-face talks. However, she said she was willing to trigger Article 16 of the Northern Ireland Protocol, a move that would suspend parts of the treaty designed to prevent a hard border with the Irish Republic if a deal could not be struck with the European Union. In response, the EU ambassador to the United Kingdom, João Vale de Almeida, said, "It was not very helpful that we keep agitating the issue of Article 16," and insisted that the European Union was eager to reconnect with the British government. European Union's ambassador to Britain, João Vale de Almeida, told Sky News, "We've heard this before from the government, so we're not surprised. We're not too impressed. We still believe it's not very helpful that we keep agitating the issue of Article 16. I think what we should focus on, at least that's where we are focused on, is trying to find solutions for difficulties in the implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
For Muslims, Virgin Mary is the manifestation of piety and spiritual purity. Imam Khamenei, December 24th, 2018. From the viewpoint of Muslims, Virgin Mary is the manifestation of piety and spiritual purity. And Mary, the daughter of Imran, who guarded her chastity. So he breathed into her of our inspiration. The Holy Quran, Surah 66, verse 12. This has been repeated several times in the Holy Quran. Humanity is in need of Jesus Christ's teachings against oppression. Jesus Christ was equipped with the power of performing miracles and carried a divine message for humanity which saved them from the darkness of polytheism, atheism, ignorance and oppression, and guided them towards justice, knowledge, and worshipping God. And this is the lesson which all Christians and Muslims who believe in the prophethood of Jesus Christ should learn. Today, humanity is in need of those teachings more than ever before.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Iranian minorities made significant sacrifices for their country. January 26, 2015. Whenever I go to the houses of Armenian and Assyrian martyrs, this year too, I fortunately managed to visit the houses of a number of Armenian martyrs, I see that they are committed to their country. They have really behaved in a committed way. I remember that during the time of war, a number of Armenian Christians went to Ahwaz. I saw that a number of people were sitting inside the airport. I asked, "Who are these people?" They said they are Armenians and they are going to the front lines for industrial affairs. They have come to render services. The Armenians are skilled at industrial and technical affairs. The late Chamran employed them. They made efforts, they rendered services, and some of them were martyred. One of the members of an Armenian family, who I visited last week, had a son in the army. He said, when his military service was over, he was unhappy because the war was continuing. He said, "My military service is over. What should I do now?" Later on, it was announced that those who have done the military service for a few months should join the army again. He became happy at this call-up, and he joined the front lines. Later on, he was martyred, and his body was brought to us. We can witness such nationalistic feelings among our non-Muslim compatriots. Well, they made efforts, and we hope that the Islamic government can carry out its responsibility in this regard. They really behaved in a committed, in the true sense of the word, way towards the country.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As Afghans are struggling with a rising hunger combined with harsh winter, the Iranian embassy in Kabul, in cooperation with Imam Khomeini Relief Foundation, distributes rounds of aid and food to vulnerable people across Afghanistan.
Iran's humanitarian aid to the Afghan people is continuing in different provinces of Afghanistan. In the capital Kabul, we aim to provide vulnerable families with food and warm clothes. Today, these batches of relief assistance, including flour, oil, and rice, are going to be distributed among Afghan teachers and unemployed people.
Unemployment, cash shortage, and the rise in prices have switched many to poverty and hunger. Nowadays, as winter sets in, millions of Afghans are awaiting relief assistance.
We're absolutely in need of such aid. I have a family of 10. We thank Iranian people for helping us in this dire situation. Their aid can help us survive one more month. We also demand Islamic countries and the international community to support us in this harsh winter, as we are short of food and warm shelter.
I'm a teacher and have 8 children. My husband is jobless. I have been unpaid for 4 months. Nowadays, we really don't have anything to eat or heat our houses. Other teachers have the same difficult situation. What should we do if we don't rely on foreign aid? I hope such aid continues for all throughout this winter.
Iran has delivered 14 rounds of aid to the people of Afghanistan since the Taliban took over and the financial crisis in August. This comes as nearly $10 billion in Afghan assets remain frozen by the U.S. and a large number of funds to the country are halted. Harsh winter in Afghanistan is worsening the dire situation, adding to the number of people in need. Most families are relying on such assistance because it is a matter of survival for them. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
On January 9th last year, the Hassan family of Somali origin living in Cardiff, Wales, were stricken by grief. Their son, 24-year-old Mohammed Hassan, found dead in his own apartment.
around 10:30 at night. Hamoud was discovered by a friend when he tried to wake him up to go to the hospital, and they realised he was dead.
Hassan, who was only months away from being a father, was arrested on January 8th on suspicion of a breach of the peace, moved here and detained overnight.
It soon emerged that while he was here, Mahmoud came into contact with over 50 members of Cardiff Police. The next morning, he was released without a charge. When he went home, his family say he was battered and bruised and his clothing splattered in blood. He went to bed later that same day, never to wake up again.
That raised red flags for his family, who then demanded to see police body cam footage of his detention. 1 year on, they're still waiting.
By the look of it, we're not going to be able to see the footage. But if we were allowed to see the footage, if we were allowed to see the last hours of Mahmoud's life, then we would be able to, regardless of what we saw, we would be able to move on. We would be able to grieve, but we would have a closure.
An investigation launched last year by the IOPC, the police watchdog in charge of the probe, is still ongoing. So far, it served misconduct notices to 6 officers and questioned more than 40 others. Hassan's family have criticized attempts to blame him for his own death, a reference to the coroner's report last year that Hassan had been drinking and taking drugs and gotten into a fight on the night of his arrest.
If you're from a black or African, Caribbean or Asian descent in this country, you know that deaths in custody are often followed by attempts to besmirch the reputation of the victim or the victim's family. No difference in this case. But can we just say absolutely for the record that the toxicology reports do not support that assertion?
Those supporting the Hassan family in their quest for the truth say his death is yet another incident in which a black person has died after contact with British police. For Hassan's family, closure on his unexplained death is yet to come. Saeed Puriza, Cardiff, Wales.
The severe shortage of fuel in Yemen is deteriorating the healthcare system in the country. Yemen's Ministry of Health says the rate of infant deaths has increased amid the severe fuel crisis caused by the continued detention of oil ships by Saudi Arabia.
There is a high rate of infant deaths we face in our department, especially for children with congenital defects or respiratory infections. These children need intensive care and incubators, but unfortunately, the fuel crisis has caused the suspension of many important medical devices to save their lives.
Health officials here say many intensive care units and emergency rooms had to stop providing services due to the lack of fuel, which has led to the death of more patients, including children. They want the United Nations to intervene and force Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it has imposed on Yemen.
The fuel crisis has caused us many problems, especially with children who need blood transfusions and those with cancerous diseases. We need medical solutions urgently, but the fuel crisis is causing delays, and this makes saving the lives of children difficult. We urge international organizations, especially the United Nations, to do their duty and pressure Saudi Arabia to lift its siege on Yemen.
Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015. It has prevented the entry of oil vessels and seized them. This has led the war-torn country to a harsh fuel shortage.
Severe fuel crisis has significantly worsened the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where most people have no access to basic health services. And the chaos caused by the Saudi blockade, Yemeni children have suffered the most. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Palestinians protested in front of the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. The rally was held to highlight the plight of Palestinian prisoners who suffer from medical negligence by their Israeli captors. The event comes as Palestinian prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, a cancer patient held in Israeli jails, suffers a serious deterioration in his health condition. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Abu Hamid was still in a coma and fighting for his life. During a press conference, White Society for Prisoners said the Israeli regime will be forced to release Palestinian prisoners.
The Palestinian